Wilderness Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Caves are mysterious, dangerous, weird, and fascinating. And Alaskan. We have caves of rock on Prince of Wales Island and all over Southeast Alaska that are extraordinarily deep and complicated and hidden in the rainforest. And our millions of acres of glaciers have countless caves that have never been discovered, and most of them never will be. On today's show, we're going to explore something hardly any of our listeners will ever do, caving, and get a feel for what it's like and why it might be worth a try. Or maybe it's something you definitely don't want to try, but it's fun to hear about it anyway. And I've got two guests on the phone from me from Southeast Alaska, and later in the hour, we'll have an Anchorage guest too. Tony Hauser is with the Prince of Wales Island Caving Program, recreation planner for the Craig and Thorn Bay Ranger Districts at the U.S. Forest Service, and is joining us from stormy, wet Craig. Thanks for being with us, Tori.
Thanks for having me.
And Daniel Monteith is with Glacier Grotto, which is the state chapter of the Speleological Society. That's not so easy to say. And with the Tongass Cave Project, which is, I guess, no longer going on, but was a project that was exploring caves all over Southeast. And Daniel's been through more than 100 Alaskan caves, so I'm really excited to talk to him. Thanks for being with us, Daniel.
You bet.
So the original, I think most people don't think of caves and don't put caves in Alaska together. And in fact, these caves really didn't start getting discovered until, what was it, the 90s or the 80s, Daniel? Do you remember when it all got started?
Sure. It was basically the late 1980s, and Kevin Allred and his wife Carlene Allred were some of the initial explorers, and they talked to different folks from the Forest Service and then started working with a guy named Jay Rockwell, who was from Anchorage and a geologist, and they began to start looking at the caves in Southeast.
And it's all about the type of rock, yes?
Yeah. Most caves throughout the world are either found in kind of volcanic areas where you have the caves like in Hawaii, or like here in Southeast Alaska or the Wrangell-St. Elias Range, where you have them in limestone. And we have in Southeast Alaska, it's Silurian limestone, which is one of the older ones. It's about 409 to 430 million years ago that the limestone was formed down near the equator, and then via plate tectonics made its way up here.
And so the acidic water from your coniferous trees down in Southeast Alaska comes dribbling down through the mountain and kind of carves through that limestone because it has the ability to dissolve the calcium in the limestone. Is that essentially the story?
Yeah, that's essentially correct. The acidity from our muskegs, our wetland marshy areas, from the vegetation, basically then that water penetrates or hits the base limestone and just starts eating away at it. We found some of the water coming off the muskeg at pH of around 2.9 or so. So pretty acidic in some places. And that just does this chemical wearing down and forms some of the biggest caves. We find about 2,000 feet up the mountain where they have a big, steep muskeg, and it hits that limestone, and then you have these big, deep, vertical caves.
Wow, and I guess having mountains helps because you're above the water table, so your caves are not underwater, and you can explore them.
Although we do have a lot of littoral caves along the coastline that are pretty amazing, and some of those may have all kinds of archaeological potential.
What is a littoral cave? What does that mean?
Basically, that's just a fancy word for a sea cave.
Oh, neat. Wow, there's so much to talk about, and I'm really interested to get into talking about your caving adventures as you've gone and explored these caves and done the sort of anthropology and archaeology there. It's all really, really intriguing. I don't know what it is about caves that it is so intriguing and sort of mysterious. But I want to talk to Tori Hauser as well from Craig, because there is a recreational program, or at least an opportunity for the public to get into at least one of the major caves down there, right, Tori?
That's right, El Capitan Cave.
Yeah, tell us about it.
Well, El Capitan Cave is the largest mapped cave in Alaska. Doesn't mean it's the largest cave, but it's the largest one that has been mapped. And it we provide a guided tour there. And all summer long, we have GeoCorps of America interns that give these tours three times a day, and they're a two-hour tour, and people have been really happy with them. You gotta put your boots on, though, and you gotta get up this 370 staircase even before you enter into the cave. But it's a beautiful walk through temperate rainforest. You can kind of see all those pieces that Dan was talking about that helped to create the cave. So we've got the muskeg, and you've got the forest, and then you can see the epikarst and the limestone exposed, and then you enter into this giant cave, and it's a great experience.
I actually did this years ago, and I agree, it is really memorable. For one thing, you know, for the typical traveler, getting out to Prince of Wales Island is a bit of a side trip, right? I mean, it's not like on the main route, especially if you're from Anchorage.
Yeah, you got to be kind of committed to get out there.
Yeah, and then you've got to drive. It's towards the northern end of the island, right? Or it's not right in Craig by any means.
That's right. It's a two-hour drive north. Actually, it's a newly paved road.
Oh, wow.
So, today, it's not quite paved, not quite finished, but in about 2 years, it'll be a totally paved route all the way to El Cap.
Wow, amazing. Yeah, I remember bouncing around on that dirt road and then getting out there and climbing up those many, many stairs, and it's all, you know, it's very, always very wet and green there, and then you get to the cave, and it's got a big iron gate on it, which they unlock and bring you in. And there are a bunch of interesting things about it. One that I found really interesting was that I didn't quite expect, and I've been into other caves around the country, is that there are all these little channels going off in every direction. And so I guess when the water was forming the cave, it didn't all go on one route, right? It was all sort of feeding in. So you get this feeling of the whole mountain being kind of honeycombed.
That's right. And that's really typical of your karst environment in a karst, this limestone type cave, where water is coming from all different locations, and through this process of dissolution where the water is dissolving rock and then moving through, and then it has time, or it might form a droplet on a ceiling somewhere, and it stays there and is able to evaporate, and then the little bit of rock that it's carrying, it releases that onto the wall again. So it dissolves a rock in one place, and then it resolidifies it somewhere else. And so those are kind of how our formations are formed. And you'll get these little rivulets all over the place. So it does look like a big sponge work or a honeycomb.
Yeah, and I guess that there are what are they called? Stalactites that come when the water is dripping down, and it creates these things. And I don't recall if there are a lot of those in El Capitan Cave or not. Actually, it's been a while since I was there.
There are. It's actually a great place to see both stalactites and stalagmites, and even a couple of places where you can see where stalactites that hang tight to the ceiling have formed right in and connected up with a stalagmite that came up from the ground, and they've connected and made a column. So you can see all of those different kinds of formations. Plus, if you're a caver, and I don't know if Dan can substantiate this, but I think cavers are really hungry because there's cave bacon, cave popcorn, soda straws, ice cream, all kinds of different formations that are named after food in El Capitan Cave.
All right. And you go in there with a flashlight because obviously it's not like one of these cave tours in the lower 48 where they've got fancy lighting and they've sort of touristized it. It's pretty rugged in there.
It's pretty rugged. And I'm glad you brought this up because El Capitan Tour is a free tour, and you can call our Thorn Bay Ranger District, and I'm sure that you guys have the number on your website.
Yep.
And you can make a reservation, and we provide headlamps and helmets for all tours.
Okay, great. And I suppose it's probably not going on at this time of year, but in the summer.
That's right. We usually do it from about Labor Day to Memorial Day.
Okay, cool. Well, as Outdoor Explorer, today we're talking about caving in Alaska. which takes place in this limestone formation that's found in southeast Alaska. Not so much in here in south central Alaska, but it's definitely a great outdoor Alaska topic, which we don't really talk much about or hear much about. And I think a lot of people don't even know that we have all these caves. So I've got two guests with me today, Tori Hauser, who is with the Prince of Wales Island Caving Program. She's a recreation planner for the Craig and Thorne Bay Ranger District of the U.S. Forest Service, coming to us today from Craig. And Daniel Monteith, who is with Glacier Grotto, which is the speleological outfit here in Alaska, and worked on exploring caves in southeast with the Tongass Cave Project. Daniel, tell me about how you go about finding and exploring caves. That has got to be very exciting, interesting, and somewhat scary avocation.
Well, yeah, I got into caving originally down in the Ketchikan area. I was working for the Forest Service as an archaeologist, and I grew up in Seattle, kind of into mountaineering. And when we were doing some archaeological work, Jim Baichtel, the geologist, asked me if I'd come and look at some of the caves. And that was about 1992, and that year we explored, and the cave project was mapping El Capitan Cave, and that's when we did the archaeological clearance so they could open it up for tourism. Then, since then, every year the Tongass Cave Project and Glacier Grotto has done these expeditions out to different islands. We started on Prince of Wales and Hecata and Kosciuszko Islands and southern southeast, and moved our way up to Doll Island and Coronation and Chichikov, and then finally up to Glacier Bay. There's also limestone caves in the Wrangell St. Elias Range, which we've done a little bit of work there, but not as much. It's just amazing because so many of the mountains in the world have been climbed, but here in southeast Alaska, each year on those cave projects, we'd find anywhere from 20 to sometimes over 50 new virgin caves. And you drop down in these caves or crawl into these caves, and you never know whether it's just going to kind of dead end after 15 feet or whether you're going to rappel down in, you know, a 100-foot shaft. And so the kind of the spirit of exploration was what really drove us in the early days. The other thing was just understanding the ecology of southeast Alaska a lot more. We started to realize how the caves are part of a kind of a three-dimensional aspect of the landscape, and how important the caves and the karst is to the fisheries and so many other aspects, the hydrology of the area.
Wow, that's interesting. I want to get into that later, but I'm curious about how you go about finding caves. I mean, because seems to me they're probably really well hidden, right? And it's probably not that obvious.
Yeah, they can be pretty elusive because some of our biggest caves on different islands are some of the most humble entrances you could possibly imagine. They're literally maybe a foot by a foot or two, and we have to kind of move away a few rocks to then kind of squeeze down in. And then these things can go for, you know, a few or several hundred feet. It's pretty amazing. Usually we look for the muskegs where they kind of, where the muskegs meet the limestone. And the muskegs then are carving out, as we talked about earlier. And so if you look for muskegs in higher areas or that where you've got the water, then you're going to probably find some pretty good-sized caves. But it does require a lot of walking over the ground, sometimes in old clear-cut areas, sometimes second growth. Sometimes you're fortunate to find some in some old-growth areas.
It seems like it would be very dangerous to go into a cave that's completely unexplored and in the dark and really not knowing anything about what's in there.
Yeah, you need to make sure you have at least three sources of light. I wouldn't recommend, one of my best friends is my caving helmet. Most of these caves require a good single rope techniques, and so awareness of and how to really use mechanical climbing devices for single rope techniques. And they can be very wet and cold. We've had cavers from all over the world come, and they say our caves can be humbling just in the sense that they're, some of them are very tight, squeezy, muddy, wet caves. But we also attract some pretty amazing cavers from all over the world who are interested in this aspect of cave exploration. It's not too often that you can, you know, name new caves and passages every day and map out these new unexplored caves.
Right. That's got to be one of the great pleasures of the sport, I would think. And Tori, do you get a lot of sort of explorers coming out there to Craig and asking about, like, where do we get into the caves, and people who have a lot of cave experience coming to check it out?
Definitely. There's definitely a lot of interest. But the cave community is a pretty tight one. And I think that people that are really interested and know about caves will contact the Glacier Grotto, and they try to become involved and do the mapping and use the right skills. And then other folks that are kind of more on the tourist end and just want to see caves and maybe aren't as versed in roping techniques and that sort of thing, I think that there's some interest, but that information is it's kept pretty quiet. So there's some local information for sure that people have just stumbled upon caves, and people go into it, but I don't think that it's out there for just anybody to find. So basically the Forest Service best recommendation is to become involved with your local grotto group like the Glacier Grotto.
So it's like you don't try to climb Mount McKinley without a guide and without a technical expertise, and shouldn't try to go into a cave without learning something about caving.
That's definitely the idea.
Yeah. We have that Glacier Grotto website on our website at alaskapublic.org. Just scroll down to where you see today's show, Caving in Alaska, and also information there on how to reach the Craig Thorne Bay Ranger District and get more information about what's going on there. I recall when I visited, Tori, that there are other caves that are pretty accessible. There was one that had a salmon run in it. There was one that was like a huge vertical shaft. I guess I'm kind of a chicken. I found them rather intimidating and wouldn't like go diving into them. But I would think that there are plenty of 20-year-old males who would find out about those places and would potentially just sort of dive in and get in trouble. And I wonder if you have to deal with that, or if you have any kind of rescue stuff that you have to do, or is that just not an issue down there?
Well, it's a great question. I would say that lure is definitely there. But I also think that people do have some respect for the area and for the inherent dangers, the cold, the 300 vertical feet in some cases, and probably aren't going to come and tell the federal government about it.
Tell that they did
so
it, yeah.
I probably don't hear about all of the exciting adventures necessarily. But I did want to make one really strong point, and not only are the caves, some of them dangerous for people that are not expecting some of the vertical drops and the tight squeezes and the flooding that can occur, spontaneous flooding that can happen in these caves, but that we can cause irreparable damage to the caves. And so we have to be very conscious of that when we enter caves as well.
Yeah, and I know that in the tour into El Capitan Cave, you've got it bolted and a gate across it so people can't just wander in. And I remember reading that there was kind of a sad situation where somebody went in there before it was closed off and did quite a bit of damage to it.
can be the case. It can be, you know, these stalactites and stalagmites, especially when they're wet and you're shining a light on them, they're very beautiful. But when you break them off and take them home, they lose a lot of their luster because they're dried out and they don't look the same. But, you know, there's definitely that feeling like, oh, gosh, I'd really like to have a piece of this. And some of those formations take thousands and thousands of years to form. And just by our hands touching it and the oils in our hands can change that whole formation process. So at El Capitan, we try to be as cognizant of our leave no trace practices as possible.
So, and how big is the El Capitan cave, and how much of it do you take folks into for your tours?
Well, there's about 2 miles of mapped channels, and just like we said earlier, they go all different directions. There's like 3 different layers. So there's a layer above you on the tour and a layer below you, and the tour is about 800 feet. And 800 feet doesn't sound like a lot, but it actually does take about an hour to go through it.
And you are in total darkness, as I recall. I mean, if you're, there's no question about, like, you're under a mountain.
That's right. Definitely. We like to turn our lights off at a point so that everybody can feel that total darkness.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of reminds me of Tom Sawyer when Tom and Becky get lost in the cave, you know, and it's such a scary part of the book. It's a great topic. We're talking about caving in Alaska. Tori Hauser with the U.S. Forest Service. She's at the Craig and Thorne Bay Ranger District and is a recreation planner, and Daniel Monteith of Glacier Grotto, which is the sort of cavers club, and who has been participated in sort of exploring 100 caves in Southeast Alaska. And we're going to hear more from them after a break. But right now I want to talk about an ice cave in the Mendenhall Glacier, which became quite a phenomenon earlier this year and then collapsed over the summer. And during our break, we're going to hear a report about that cave, the hazards, and some of the science behind it. Juno reporter Matt Miller tackled the topic last spring, and he filed this report.
Lori Craig at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center has this advice for people embarking on the mile-and-a-half hike on Mendenhall Lake out to the cave.
Just for people to be really cautious, be safe, be prepared.
The ice cave is located near the western terminus of Mendenhall Glacier. While the Forest Service is not encouraging people to visit the cave, it's not prohibiting access either. In case of an emergency, it will be Capital City Fire and Rescue, not the Forest Service, that will arrive on scene and try finding a victim in distress in the vast expanse of the glacier and the lake.
It's the kind of thing people need to be aware of, particularly those folks taking lots of children out. Keep the children with you. Be prepared for rescuing yourself, because it's very difficult for anybody else to get out there.
Signs are posted warning visitors of the dangers of the glacier and lake ice, part of which she calls a dynamic environment. Jason Amundsen is associate professor of geophysics at the University of Alaska Southeast and has researched tidewater glaciers and glacier-ocean interactions. He says the cave was likely formed by a stream coming down off of nearby Mount McGinnis.
The water is carrying heat with it, and that heat goes to melting the ice. And then I guess as it's gotten bigger in the summer, there's water running into that ice cave, but there's also warm air that can make its way into the ice beneath the glacier.
Another stream on the glacier surface found a fissure or a crack and over time created the giant circular shaft or moulin that allows daylight into the far accessible end of the cave.
A fairly common feature on glaciers, you get water running over the surface of a glacier and it drops into a crevasse. Basically, because the water is more dense than ice, it wants to move downward, and so it basically drills a hole through the glacier. And so that's probably just something that formed at the surface. Could have been there for a long time, and maybe it's just now, as the glacier has moved down valley, it's now just right in the same spot as where the ice cave is.
Amundsen says different layers of the glacier may flow at different rates. Same for the center versus the edges, where friction with the ground and surrounding hills can slow the ice movement. UAS Environmental Science Associate Professor Aaron Hood believes the ice in that area may be over 200 years old.
You can see in the walls there's a lot of subglacial sediment that's been entrained, and so some areas the ice looks actually quite dark because there's a lot of sediment in there, which is the glaciers just picked up.
Visitors to the glacier can be deceived by the apparent stillness and sublime beauty of the area. The Mendenhall calves all the time, even in the winter. Lori Craig says the five-story high, snow-covered blocks of blue ice near the western edge broke off about a week ago. Calving events can cause lake ice to undulate or even shatter over large areas.
Someone who was skiing on the lake when that happened on Thursday afternoon, and he said he could feel the ripple as it rolled across the lake.
Landslides off Mount Bullard near the eastern edge of the glacier and the slow, constant movement of the glacier could mean perpetually thin and unstable lake ice at the terminus. Underwater currents can also erode the underside of ice-locked icebergs, causing them to unexpectedly flip or roll with a change in the center of gravity. Lori Craig says she will never cross the lake ice.
There's no way to predict what's going to happen, but you can always hear creaking and groaning because it's continuously moving down the slope, even in the wintertime. And if you get a look at the terminus, you'll see that there's just a huge jumble of great big icebergs. And they'll stay there until the lake ice thaws, but it's an indication of how much ice is falling off all the time. So any place where people congregate, at least it should be hopefully on land.
While the interior of the ice cave is essentially on land and several dozen feet under the glacier, the overhead ice at the entrance may only be several feet or even a few inches thick. Aaron Hood says he escorted a photographer to the back of the cave 2 years ago, but he won't take his child there.
The one dangerous place, in my view anyway, is near the entrance to the cave where you have some overhanging ice that's pretty thin and you could actually have blocks breaking off there. And I just didn't feel like taking my five-year-old daughter back through there and feeling like something could fall down on us.
Hood says deep inside the cave is relatively solid, but there is always a risk of collapse. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're talking about caving in Alaska today. And Tori Hauser is with us from Craig with the U.S. Forest Service, Daniel Monteith, a cave explorer from Juneau. And now in the studio with me is Senator Hollis French, who was in the legislature for 12 years. He's just ending his time voluntarily in the legislature, but has spent 12 winters in Juneau. And then this last winter, you were able to experience this Mendenhall cave that we were just hearing about in that report from Matt Miller, which has since collapsed. It's not there anymore.
Right. It's a feature that had been gaining in popularity and sort of renown. And some folks that I'd run into a couple times in the coffee shops around Juneau had said, "Have you been to the ice cave? You got to go to the ice cave. It'll change your life." And so it sort of acquired this buzz that it was just one of these must-do events. And so as the legislature was winding down on a quiet weekend, in fact, the legislature had ended, and I'd stuck around for another week of wrapping up and putting my apartment away. A local guy, Jim Powell, in fact, an assemblyman, former assemblyman from Juneau, Beth Kertula's husband, great guy, now a prophet, UAS, said, "Hey, let's go out to the cave." So we made it this great sort of adventure to go find it. Neither one of us had been there, and you know, we wanted to know exactly where it was. And there's two ways to go. You can either go across the lake, as we were just hearing during the show from Juneau. You can go across the lake from the Mendenhall Visitor Center, cut in front of the face of the glacier, and then get to the ice cave. Or you can go over land. And it being springtime and the ice going out of the lake, we went over land.
Okay, and how big is this? What, or we should say was, because it's not there anymore.
Apparently, the outside is now sort of collapsed, and I haven't been back since then. But it was about an hour's hike from the trailhead along the, I think it was the West Glacier Trail,
right.
And it was pretty well marked. And yet, you know, the last quarter of a mile, you were sort of going through some brush and then over some moraine. Not hard hiking, but a little bit challenging. But once you get to the mouth of the cave itself, it was a fairly large opening. You know, I'd say probably 100 feet across and 50 feet high.
Wow, that's huge.
Yeah, it was a big opening.
And
what was interesting is you would sort of peer down in there, and you knew it went a ways back there, but there was lots of water raining down. The glacier is melting all the time, of course,
in the
summer.
That's a little freaky.
It is, and you can hear creaks and whatnot, and yet, it felt you know, scary enough to want to bring you in, and yet safe enough to pull it off. I mean, I'm not the most danger-loving person, but, you know, I'll take risks like most folks will, but it felt like it was just okay. So we put on our jackets and wandered in, and the thing you noticed right away was just the stunning blue. It was the bluest place you've ever been.
Because the light is coming down through the ice.
Right. Right. You're not super deep underneath the surface of the glacier. You're probably, 200 feet underneath the surface of the glacier. And so the light is penetrating through the snow on the top of the glacier and then into the ice and then finally down to where you are. And you're seeing is just the bluest blue you've ever seen. And what was probably most interesting was that at the back of the cave, where it should have been darkest, there was in fact a shaft of light. From, as you heard in the report, there was a moulin, a place where the water on the top of the glacier seeks an exit. And so the moulin had melted a shaft all the way down to bedrock, and that brought in sunlight. So at the very back of this dark cave with this sort of surreal blue is a shaft of bright sunlight that you could get all the way back to and stand in the middle of and look up at the sky. And so it was just a very, very exciting experience to be inside this cave, listening to the glacier move a little bit, seeing the blue, and then the sunlight at the back.
Wow. So how far back did the cave go?
Probably about 100 yards. I mean, it was not, you could see the back of it when you walked in, so you couldn't tell if it went beyond there, and it really didn't. But it was just extremely interesting and exciting to be inside the glacier.
But you're not walking on ice. You're walking on rock?
You're on bedrock, right? Yeah. You're on bedrock, and there's a little bit of a stream there where the water that had run down through the glacier would collect, and then it went on out at the back of the cave. I suppose you could have slithered into there in a wetsuit or something, but for 99% of the visitors, you stopped at that moulin, at that shaft of light at the back.
So this kind of became a popular Juneau thing, and everybody was going, though the Forest Service sounds like they didn't particularly like that.
They weren't encouraging it, and yet there were just enough traffic to where they had to sort of recognize that it was part of the landscape. And the day we were there, I think two people came out of the cave as we arrived, and when we left, we saw probably three more groups of folks headed that direction. It was a Saturday. It was a day off, but 10, 15 visitors a day, I'm sure, was pretty standard through the summer.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if it reforms.
Exactly, or forms in a different place. Mm-hmm. But it's become so well known that I'm sure people will habitually visit the mouth of that cave over time to see if it opens back up again.
Well, I remember a few years ago going down to the Mendenhall Visitor Center, and that there was really a path worn across the lake to the face of the glacier.
Right.
And you could go up there and sort of, you'd be standing among these huge spires of ice. I grew up in Alaska, and I was raised to be terrified of that. And I felt extremely nervous when I was doing it because that those things can give way at any time, but a lot of people are doing it, and it hasn't been a disaster yet.
That's, you sort of get lulled in, I think, by the fact that, well, if you see somebody else do something, well, then it must be okay.
Right.
That person may have zero knowledge whatsoever, safety sense, but, it's a human being doing something.
That would be the lemming argument, right?
We're all sort of influenced by one another. But, I don't think that's the only glacier that has that effect, because I've seen much smaller examples of that here in Anchorage at Byron Glacier. Mm-hmm. As you walk up that Byron Valley and you get to the snout of the Byron Glacier, and as you get up on it, you'll see places where the water's rushing out of the bottom of the glacier, so to speak, and so it's carving a little hole out, and you can kind of stick your head in there and look, and you can tell under right conditions the same kind of thing would happen, that the water would carve out this hole where the snow and the ice meets bedrock and make an opening. So there's got to be more of them, and I'm sure there have been more, but the one in Juneau was just so perfectly located, an hour from the trailhead, enough to make it a bit of an adventure, and yet the size of it and the depth, and I think you put a photo of it up on your website.
If
folks haven't looked, you've just got to check it out, because it's very surreal.
Magnificent, yeah. So And they're skiing on the lake, Minnehaha Lake.
Yeah, you know, it's a
just
well-used...
as there is on the lake, Portage Lake, in front of Portage Glacier.
Same thing. Bikers,
and then periodically,
hikers,
the ice will just break up, and everybody says,
happen.
"Whoa, glad
things
I wasn't out there when it happened."
Yeah, no, yeah. We're all sort of Alaskans in
that's
that
right.
sense, where you sort of think, "Well, we do it; it must be okay." And if there's a disaster, well, it'll happen. You know, when I'm back in town.
Yeah. Well, let me bring Dan Monteith
yeah.
in on this. Dan, have you did you check out the Minnehaha Glacier Cave?
Yeah, I sure have. It's a pretty amazing, or was a pretty amazing thing to go visit. And folks would go there during the winter time, and then I think some folks during the summertime. You definitely want to be careful, at the foot of the glacier there, where you could have ice and snow falling off. But for a while, and particularly during the winter time, a relatively kind of safe adventure there. And a fair number of folks were going there, so you'd have other folks that would maybe know, if something went awry. Right now, we'll have to wait and see if it how it develops again. And that's how our Alaskan chapter of the National Speleological Society got named, the Glacier Grotto, because originally Jay Rockwell and others in the Anchorage area and a few down here in southeast Alaska started checking out some of the caves in ice tunnels and caves in glaciers, and thus the Glacier Grotto. So,
huh. So that came before the rock caves was looking into these glacier caves.
Exactly. Some of the early folks who got interested, and then folks started transitioning as they started finding different caves in the Wrangell-St. Elias area, and then down here started exploring those.
So is this something you've done elsewhere, or have you mostly concentrated on the rock caves?
In terms of the rock caves, yeah, mostly... stuck to the rock caves. I haven't done a lot of the glacial caves or tunnels. I haven't had a chance to do some caving in Russia, and that was some of the cavers who came over here and helped us do some mapping and exploring in the mid-90s. So that was kind of an interesting friendship that was cultivated and developed by folks who came over here to see our caves.
I've noticed these kinds of... caves that are snow and ice. I mean, if you go out in the spring, like in Prince William Sound, and climb up to one of those waterfalls, you'll often see areas where there's a huge amount of snow that's maybe 15 feet thick, and then the water has carved underneath it, a big sort of cathedral-sized chamber that you can walk through. Although you feel very nervous in there because obviously it's ephemeral, and I wonder if these glacier caves, and maybe either of you gentlemen might know or might not. If these, or maybe Tori knows, if these are sort of things that are ephemeral and they exist and then they go away and then they might show up somewhere else, or if they're kind of consistent and always showing up in the same place. Do you know, Hollis?
I don't, although I right now I'd be fascinated to go back and look and see what's left of the cave that we visited there at the Mendenhall to see whether it's just the outer edge that's collapsed or whether it appears as if the entire glacier sort of gave way to come down to Earth. And my suspicion is that it's just the outer edge, that mm-hmm. there's been some big, sort of flake, if you will, maybe 100 feet long, but thin, that sort of broke down to cover the entrance. But maybe one of the other guests has been out there.
Daniel, have you checked it out since it collapsed?
I have not gotten back there. Yeah, but these the caves and the glaciers. Of course, every glacier has a different kind of constitution in terms of its history and dynamics, and that kind of plays a factor in how stable some of those caves or tunnels could be in the glaciers. There's been a lot of research recently done on glaciers to understand more about their physical structure and how they're changing with climate change and other things like that too.
Right. So the ice is always moving, and so that's going to tend to change things. But then the water always has to find its way down, and it's always going to tend to want to go in the same route. So it may be something that has some consistency. I'd be interested to know that, but it's certainly really interesting, and it's really... So Hollis is showing me some pictures here in the studio, which are, I think we've got some on our Facebook page at Outdoor Explorer and also on our website, just how beautiful it is, that the way the water has carved this ice and it's kind of translucent and blue and all that. So and I guess the light sort of filters its way down.
Yeah, it's just a very surreal light. I don't think you could make it any other way than this. But to pass it through, you know, 100 feet of this ice, and then have the blue just staring in the face like that.
I think that's one of the things that's so interesting about caves, and probably Dan and Tori would agree with this, is that it's an environment that's so different from everything we're used
exactly.
to, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's like stepping through a wall into a different world. I mean, you're operating out there on the surface, and suddenly you realize that there's this whole subterranean mm-hmm. sort of parallel universe.
Yeah.
And you wonder sort of how far into the glacier's, bowels this thing stretches.
Yeah, I kind of felt that way, Tori, Dan, in the El Capitan cave, partly because you knew that these channels were reaching off in every direction, you know, and it would take, you know, as you said, it's a couple miles, but it feels like it's infinite, reaching off in all directions.
Yeah, and there's so many parts of it where people haven't been. I mean, you really can be the first person to see some of those places.
Yeah, yeah, very cool. Well, we're gonna let Hollis French go, and we're gonna take another short break. And when we come back, we're gonna continue talking about caves in Southeast Alaska and these limestone formations, including the archaeological, anthropological aspects. Yes, ancient people used these caves for different purposes, and also the ecological aspects. Animals and fish and stuff are in the caves in this hidden world that's down under the ground. Thanks very much for being with us, Senator French.
My pleasure. Thanks, Charles. Great show.
All right. We'll be back in a few moments. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're back. My name is Charles Wolforth. We're talking about caving in Alaska with Tori Hauser of the U.S. Forest Service. She's in Craig, where she manages a caving program and tours of El Capitan Cave. And Daniel Monteith, who joins us from Juneau. He's with Glacier Grotto, which is the state chapter of the National Speleological Society. And he's spent a lot of time exploring caves in the limestone of Southeast Alaska. And I wanted to talk a little bit more about the ecology and the anthropology of caves. These caves we've talked a lot about them just being explored and just discovered for the first time. But of course, Alaska Natives and Indigenous people probably used them a long time ago. What sort of anthropological or archaeological resources have you found in the caves, Dan?
Yeah, the caves have been pretty amazing. They've been windows into the past for us. Of course, in Southeast Alaska, we have a rainforest climate, so it doesn't lend well to the preservation of organic materials. And in the early 90s, we started finding a lot of animal or paleontological remains. And you know, there's two types of major caves, one that's kind of a horizontal kind of shaft-like cave, and then there's caves that we call sinkholes. And those sinkholes oftentimes end up being a place where animals trotting across the landscape or the countryside, and all of a sudden, particularly the wintertime, I would imagine, because some of these get a little obscured, animals end up falling into these sinkholes. And that's pretty typical around the world, where there's some pretty amazing paleontological finds in sinkhole-type caves. And we started finding that to be true in Southeast Alaska. And if folks really wanted to learn more about it, we've had a longtime paleontologist from the University of South Dakota, Tim Heaton, who has a wonderful website and has done work since the early 90s, from El Capitan Cave to also working on and finding the human remains that were found in the mid-90s in a cave on the northern end of Prince of Wales.
So how old are these things?
The animal remains pretty amazing. Some of them are pushing radiocarbon dates. We started finding brown bears on islands in southern southeast where we don't have brown bears today. And the dates on some of those brown bears were dating from about 9,000 to 40-plus thousand years ago. Like I said, pushing kind of radiocarbon dating techniques. And so that gave us a clue that that areas and kind of foraging areas of brown bears might have been different, that the ecology might have been different. And we started learning about places of refugia where the ice didn't come out to some of the outer islands through the discovery in the caves.
Right, because if you're talking 40,000 years ago, that would give you a couple of ice ages back, right? Within the last 10,000 or 15,000, we've had ice covering most of Alaska.
Right. At the 10,000 years ago, plain and simple, you get to the end of the Wisconsin Ice Age. And so 40,000 puts you that much farther back into the Wisconsin Glacial Ice Age and the Pleistocene. And we were finding about 18,000 years ago, there was a ring seal, which you can tell by they have these claws on their flippers. So that sort of seal would have maybe been indicative of pack ice here 18,000 years ago. We found red fox, which is much more of an Arctic type fox that we found in the caves. So a variety of different animal species that was indicating at least 15, 18, 20,000 years ago and older, that the ecology of southeast Alaska might have been quite a bit different.
But might have been more like what the Arctic is like now.
Exactly.
Wow.
And so that during the end of the Pleistocene, we really did have this a different kind of climate ecology down here. The other factor that really plays an interesting role in the caves is, you know, in this area we had about a 300 to 400 foot change in sea level at the end of the Pleistocene about, 18,000 years ago. Sea level started rising pretty dramatically, 300 to 400 feet. And so there's some of those caves, as I was talking about earlier, that could be littoral caves underwater that might have some interesting archaeological or paleontological potential.
Sounds like quite a challenge to scuba dive in a cave.
Yeah, we've had some folks come up, and in the mid-90s, we had ESPN Extreme Sports come up, and they were going to do a special on the caves, and I think they found it kind of humbling because as cave diving goes, the caves are fairly tight and pretty extreme in cold temperatures. So it makes for, you definitely, there, that goes way beyond my level of expertise. And I always tell my wife, if I take up cave diving, worry about me. But
you probably don't even need to tell her that. She'd probably figure that out for herself.
Right. I've been stuck in squeezes on rope, and that doesn't bother me too much if I'm not limited by the amount of oxygen I have. But, you're down there on rope and kind of stuck in an area, you got to go through some meditation and some gentle breathing and kind of work yourself out of some of these.
You're giving me a nightmare. I'm going to have a nightmare tonight. About this. That sounds so. You're down like in the total darkness underneath a mountain, and your body is stuck in a cave. That sounds really scary.
Well, the flip side is, you know, you go down a 300-foot shaft, you get to the bottom, and then all of a sudden it opens up into this huge kind of corridor that you could run a train through. And that was a cave we called on Hecate Island, Arabica, and it had this long kind of passageway that went for quite a ways, and you could tell that this was this major underground kind of stream and hydrological system thousands of years ago. Mm. So, and actually, we were mapping that kind of passageway, and like I said, you could literally put a train through part of that. That's how wide and tall it was. And then we had several days of heavy rain during the summertime, and we had kind of left that cave and gone to exploring some other ones. And when we went back down, we dropped down the sinkhole on rope, and then we worked our way down to that main passageway, and it was sumped or flooded almost up to the top of that passageway.
Wow.
So that's kind of a how you got to be careful in any cave system, you mm-hmm. know, particularly with the amount of rain we have. It tells you how much hydrology in the water is kind of important part of forming the caves, but also how the caves are kind of this underground ecology all its own.
Right.
It's really kind of fascinating. And the
let me ask Tori about that, because I kind of remember one of those caves there in Prince of Wales. There were salmon spawning in the cave, or at least a stream that was going through a cave to a salmon spawning stream. Is that right, Tori?
That's right. It's right up there by El Cap. There's another sort of public access area called Cavern Lake. And Cavern Lake is, I think, is what you're describing. There's a salmon creek that comes right out of a cave, and you can see the salmon. They've come right down from the lake, and they go through all the passages, and they come out, and you can see them there just spawning in the river.
Huh.
It's pretty amazing.
What kind of other wildlife use of the caves are you aware of? Does wildlife use the caves? It would seem like it might be handy for them.
Right. Well, you have been describing our gate on El Capitan Cave a couple times, big iron gate. Well, that's actually the bat gate. And we're actually just finishing up Bat Week, where we get to celebrate all of our bats. And Alaska does have quite a few bats. On Prince of Wales, we know of the little brown bat and the California bat, and both of them reside in their winter times in El Capitan Cave. So we put this bat gate up to protect the bats and to protect people. And it's specially designed so bats can fly in and out of it using their sonar. So bats are definitely in there in the wintertime, and then they come out and they live in the forest in the summertime. Hmm. So they're not in there usually when we're having our tours.
Do the white nose syndrome that it killed off most of the bats in the lower 48, or are they, has that showed up here?
Well, that's a great question, because white nose syndrome is a cold weather fungus, and so our climate is actually a really good climate for that disease to take effect. But fortunately, we have not found any cases of white nose syndrome west of the Mississippi.
Oh, okay.
So,
good.
Fortunately, we haven't, but we do actually take precautions. We always ask people before going in the cave if they've worn those clothes in any of the eastern caves that they've visited, that sort of thing. So mm-hmm. we try very hard, because we do realize that, hurting our bats up here could really hurt some of our industry and our pollination and our trees.
Yeah, and it's catastrophic back there on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. So I interrupted you. You were about to talk about some more ecological things in the cave.
Yeah, well, it's really exciting, because there's this great evidence of all these different creatures using the cave. So we talked about the bats, and then also, if you look at the bat gate on the bottom, there's all these little hairs, so that you can see something has been crawling in there, and everyone suspects that it's a river otter that climbs all the way up this mountain and comes into the darkness of the cave in the winter to rear her pups. So we want to put a camera in and see if this is actually what's taking place, but that's kind of the running theory. And then, just like Dan was saying, there's lots of bones and different pieces of evidence of all different kinds of animals, even caribou, brown bears, black bears, frogs, toads. What else have we found in there? Little bats. And then there's human evidence. And we've found that in El Capitan Cave, we have little bits of charcoal, and we carbon dated that, and that people have been in this cave way back, at least several hundred feet into this cave 3,600 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you can see it would be a great shelter, right? It's one of the only places to get out of the rain in Craig or in the Prince of Wales Islands.
Yeah, especially especially today.
Yeah.
But what's fascinating about that is, you know, we don't really know the reasoning, and as an archaeologist, Sam can speak to this a little bit more, but it's a lot farther to go into the cave than just to seek shelter.
Right.
Somebody had was really committed, and what we found with our evidence, it doesn't look like people were, like, living in there, really hanging out. There's not a lot of bones from where people have left their food things and at big fires. It looked more like people kind of came that far back just occasionally.
Maybe they were hiding in a war or something, huh?
Something like that, yes. Yeah. So there's lots of different theories.
What do you think, Dan, just in a few minutes we have left, what kind of human usage was made of the caves in prehistoric times?
Yeah, we found, there was the human remains that were found that go back to about 9,700 years old. Folks probably were using these on the outer coast. There's places where they're probably using them to get out of the weather for a short period of time on islands where you could imagine if you were cruising around in a canoe or something and have a bad storm, that you might seek these caves out for at least a temporary sort of shelter. They're a little wet and moist in a lot of places, so probably not the ideal place to live in. And, of course, they had these beautiful, wooden houses that they constructed. So they probably weren't long-term permanent areas where they were living. They were also using them probably for spiritual aspects. We found some pretty amazing pictographs in a few of the caves. Some of those places would be almost World Heritage Sites because you can look at them and the beautiful designs are pretty amazing. They were also used probably just for exploration, discovery. Some cases, maybe even hunting. Like up north, they would hunt bears in caves during the fall time, winter time. Many places across the northern latitudes, folks would go into caves for bears. And we know that the bears were going in and hibernating in these caves. So that's a possibility also.
Just fascinating. So, Tori, we only have a half a minute left here, but let folks know about how they can learn more about El Capitan Cave and the tours that you do.
Well, the best thing to do is to go on the Forest Service website for the Tongass National Forest and look up El Capitan Cave, and then they can just call me. My number is 907-826-1614, and I'd be happy to tell them about the times and the programs. And we also open the cave up for school groups outside of our normal season so that schools can come and visit the cave with our tours. And we just like to have people come and enjoy it.
And we will make sure all that information is available on our website at alaskapublic.org. Just check out today's show, Caving in Alaska. I want to thank all three of my guests, Tori Hauser, who is with the U.S. Forest Service at the Craig and Thorne Bay Ranger District, Daniel Monteith, who is with the Glacier Grotto Group. It's the state chapter of the National Speleological Society. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks so much.
And, thank you.
And earlier we had Senator Hollis French with us. Please tune in again next week. We will be doing a show on subsistence and climate change. What kind of changes have Alaska Native people faced as the climate has been changing? Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.